what national recognition I have, like the, you know, People Magazine and Christian Science Monitor, is because of the Voice Library. It's a, I don't often think of it as cute. It's a valuable thing. I think it is a valuable thing. And if they go online, then anybody who wants a classroom teaching on Martin Luther King Day can pick up I Have a Dream. But anybody can pick it up at his home. You could do that right now. You can pick up Nothing to Fear But Fear Itself, you know.
Did you see an increase in requests after the collections became on or went online in terms of the catalog or no?
There's an increase, and they've hired a very expensive man with a PhD from Chicago to say no.
Oh.
They've hired a copyright officer, and he's got a huge staff. Hell, they spend more on saying no in a year than I probably said yes in 10 years, you know. It became something of value, and we found out it was something of value when other parts of the university decided to appropriate it. When Mark Kornbluh in history said, wow, I found the forest. Well, it wasn't quite a forest, it was a farm. Somebody had been plowing it for these years. This stuff doesn't grow wild, you know. You gotta bring it in and plant it. But I could tell that we're getting famous when various people wanted to steal us. And I think that's fine. I believe the world's goods belong to the world's people. Dick Chapin always told me I'd wind up in Sing Sing for giving away valuable stuff. I said, it didn't cost me anything. He said, it's all that passed through you. He said, I'm not even going to visit you when you go to jail. I'm fine. That's the kind of encouragement I got in the library. But it was a fun thing. I go to the library every Friday because Randy Scott and Don DePorter and I have fake books down there, and we are playing every popular tune we can on accordion, guitar, and clarinet. We're just going through every, because it amuses us. Mm-hmm. We go down in the back of the rare book room where nobody can hear us, and it amuses me to play as loud as I can in a library. Then I take John and Rick to coffee, and we talk about a world that has passed into legend for them, you know, that there once was a thing called Camelot, you know. We did have a good time. Nobody in the library knew what we were doing. And now nobody knows what we've done. Yeah. But there's grant money to be had, and they will use this either wisely or unwisely. I don't know. But I didn't worry about copyright because I don't worry about things, and I figured anybody who sued me, you know, would get experience in getting money.
How did your work or your appearances on the J.P. McCarthy show? Do you remember the first time?
Yeah.
How did you end up on his? Was it Focus?
It was on the Focus show, yeah. And Ed Zabruski was always bringing him interesting people from Michigan State. And J.P.'s a wonderful interviewer, just perfect. He asks a question and he falls back, and what he would do is we would record it about a couple hours before it went on the air, so that if it was no good, he'd just pull out a golden oldie. That's why I'm always on. Every time somebody really screws up, they just, they've got a list of about 15 guys that they just play. Mm-hmm. But he has two people, and the one he thinks is going to be better, he has first. It's a half-hour show, and I did 25 minutes, and then some poor guy is trying to collect money for the Armenians, you know, get up there and talk fast. JP and I both come from New Jersey. I love his show, and he thought I was cute, and they tried to get me as often as they could. I told Ed Zabruski, I don't drive in Detroit. But Ed likes to drive anyway, so we would drive in. And then we'd stop at a nice place and get something to eat, and we'd listen to the radio show. You introduced me once, just after JP had died. I hadn't thought, if I were to give that speech now, I would have said, J.P. McCarthy left no written record. If there weren't a voice library, people would be unable to say, oh, was that guy good? You want to prove it? Go to Michigan State and listen. Mm-hmm. I've got him doing Joe Waldmeier on Hemingway. And I think it's a phoner, and I think Joe is in Spain at the time. And these are two great talkers, you know. But Joe McCarthy did what Russ and I did. He made you feel smart, you know. He listened to everything you said. It was not J.P. Dick Cavett, it's the Dick Cavett show. He tells Lou Alcindor how to play baseball, you know, about basketball. He tells Gloria Swanson how to be an actress. What he's doing is he's saying, I went to Yale. Huh? Am I smart or what? Let me tell you about you. And there are lots of guys who do that. I did a talk show myself. It's hard not to show off. But what you really do is you do what JP did. You ask a question and you jump out of the way. And we're unlikely to see the likes of him again.
How'd you get interested in oral history?
Oh, I was stuck. We had this voice library. And so we... for a shy guy, I'm something of a wheeler dealer. I brought the National Convention here. I was in the voice library 4 years. When we brought a National Convention is usually in Savannah or Poughkeepsie or you know, New Orleans, East Lansing. It was a dry town when they came here. You couldn't drink in the Kellogg Center. We brought them here, and there was not a state organization. I had taken a course because college professors feel that's the way you learn things. I took a course in oral history from lady whose husband is an anthropologist at Wayne. Pat Pilling. Pat Pilling drove in from Detroit to give a course at LCC. Geneva Wiskeman was in the class. The local oral historians were in the class. I took Pat Pilling's course, and we became close to Pat and to the guy she eventually married. We got together, decided that they hadn't been in the Middle West for a while, and we invited them to the Kellogg Center, and Mark Van Wormer, who's a friend of mine, was running conferences there, and we ran just a hell of a conference. I mean, Schlesinger, why can't I think of his name? Junior. Arthur Schlesinger Jr. was one of the speakers. He's the main speaker, as a matter of fact. And he traced oral history back to Thucydides. It was a great speech. It had very little to do with oral history. But we had people from around the world come to this, and I decided to have a voice library there. I told people in our invitations to send tapes if they were on a project, and send dubs of tapes, and we had so many that the room that I had wasn't big enough, and so I had to put up a sign, and it said, "Other voices, other rooms." I don't know how many people got it, but we had other voices, other rooms, and we had all kinds of stuff here. And Geneva said after the meeting, let's sit around together at Justin Kestenbaum was one of the guys. Let's form a Michigan Oral History Council. And that's when it started. And I thought to myself, you know, I could get into oral history, but damn it, I'm a voice librarian, and there's only really one of them in the country. And I spent all day and all night doing this. I actually started ignoring my teaching. I didn't ignore it because I was good and I was glib and I got by and nobody ever found out, nobody ever caught on. But we formed that association. It was in 79, I think. So I was here 5 years. I came in January 1st of 74. And this was in the fall of 79. It was a little more than 5 years. And we're in the Kellogg Center. And it was a very successful convention. And it made money. It made money because I got people to donate things, including my band. We had a dance with the Geriatric Six playing at it. It was a very successful convention. And that was the beginning of... Pat was a... ball of fire, and so was Geneva, and it got going, and it's going today. We took over doing the quarterly, John Shaw and I, from this fellow who was teaching high school near Detroit.
Mm-hmm. Glenn Ruggles?
Yeah, that's right, Glenn Ruggles. Justin said, this damn paper looks like a ransom note. The kids were putting it together, this looks like a ransom note. So I took over. John Shaw's the finest assistant a man could ever have. And he's graduated with high honors in journalism. He was the number one man in his class, actually. And he's a journalist. And I've got to call myself a journalist because I'm quick and dirty. I write very fast. And I seldom rewrite. And I was a journalist at one time. I did sports for the Atlantic City Press Evening Union. And I did kind of high school sports. And we turned out what was a very, very good journal for. We just couldn't keep it up. Oh, what happened is Hiram Davis came in as the head of the library, and he wanted a library journal, and so John took that over. But John never called himself the editor. He always called me the editor, because that's the kind of guy he is.
Mm-hmm. Who else besides John worked, or is he still at the Voice Library?
Yeah, he's at the Voice Library, and I think he'll be there. He thinks of it as a job now. That's a much easier job because we get requests and we turn them over to the copyright officer and he says no. So it's John's job. And John's got lots of other things to do. He runs the, whatever it's called, that you check out stuff and you put it in the computers, that lab. He's never going to be completely appreciated because librarians feel that if you didn't go to library school, you're not a real person. You didn't take those three courses in how to say no, you know.
Who else?
And Rick is there. Rick's an engineer, and he's very good, and he's in charge of digitizing all the stuff. But it's all being held up by copyright. And maybe it should be. I think maybe it was a good time for me to leave because I was a swashbuckler. I really was a loose cannon. I just went around I called Bill Shirk a garbage collector. That's what I was. I took anything anybody would give me because I didn't have any money to buy stuff with.
more of a preservationist with the idea that you, if you didn't take it, it would be gone.
Yeah, I was. What I did is I catalog. What I say, historians always say, the job of the historian is to find the diamonds in the dung heap. And I say, and the job of the librarian is to catalog dung. In fact, I think I said that on that PBS show, that for every historian who's finding good stuff in the bad stuff, that's because the good stuff and the bad stuff are all cataloged.
When did you retire?
I retired July 1st, 2000. I started teaching September 1st, 1950. I had made up all kinds of plans for what to do in retirement. And you find out who you are in retirement. I find out that I like to shave. You don't have to shave every day. You don't have to shave at all. I shave. I find out that I like to wear ties. Anytime I can wear a tie, I go to funerals now, you know. So I can wear a necktie. When you get to be 75 years old, you've got 217 ties, of which you wear six, you know. And you want to wear them. Along comes Regis Philbin, and instead of your tie matching your suit, it's got to match your shirt. That's a good thing, because you got 14 suits and 300 shirts, you know. So Regis Philbin, the new style is to wear a tie such that people have to look to see if you're wearing one.
No contrast.
There's no contrast. But I think that's okay. I was going to take piano lessons. I thought at one time I'd go to law school. My wife says, "You want to be a lawyer?" I said, "No, I want something to do." But, geez, doing nothing is great, you know. Because what I'm doing is what I was doing over and above running the Voice Library. Mm-hmm. Except the president spoke last night, and I wasn't taking notes. I wasn't taping him. Mm-hmm. Pretty good speech. That was pretty good speech. The first five things he proposed were things that Al Gore would have proposed. Mm-hmm. I thought having a mayor of Philadelphia was great. These are the things that I was taking notes in my head. But poor John, he had to take the notes. You know, he had to take the notes.
When you came to Michigan State, did you anticipate that you'd be here your whole career?
Nobody does. Mm-hmm. Nobody does. What happened to me, and it's in that article, is I moved next door to a magnificent man. I got a job playing jazz, although didn't own a horn. I wasn't a very good musician. I'm not a good musician today, but I worked with good musicians. You know, if you want to learn to play tennis, you always play with people who are better than you are. Well, when I started playing, that was everybody.
Who was your neighbor that you mentioned?
Bill McCann. Okay. That's where I met Russ. Bill McCann had been captain of the baseball team here, and he was a reviewer for the Progressive up in Madison, Wisconsin. He was head of the actuarial department of the state insurance. And he was smarter than hell, and I met all kinds of wonderful people at his house. And then I got on the Howard Finch show, and I made so much money. I came here at $4,500 a year, highest paying job of anybody in my PhD class, $4,500 a year in 1953. In 1954, I went up to $4,700, 55, I went up to $4,900. But in 55, I got on the Howard Finch show, and I was making an extra $60 a week. I was earning less than $100 a week. I was making $60 extra. That's a 60% raise for playing jazz. We sunk it all into the house, and we paid the house off. And I learned to play jazz. And Howard Finch had me doing comedy, because I always said funny things. And One of the things I did is I would diagram sentences. I would do popular songs, and I'd say, "Just Molly and Me," which is a noun clause modifying, "We are happy," not, and "Baby Makes Three," which is a parallel noun clause, and I write it out, modifying, "We're happy." I said, "What did I tell you?" I said, "When whippoorwills call," said noun, "and evening is nigh." I said, "Well, that's interesting because it mentions the head of the English department." And it was just so easy to do. Every time it rains pennies from heaven. I said, "This is the Michigan National Cloud Bank." We had a singer on the show named Jerry Ray. Jerry could never remember my name. Oh, it was Howard Fincher called me Mari. That's how I got the name Mari. I was Mari on television, so. And there was only one television station in town. It was Channel 6, WJIM. She couldn't remember my name, so she called me Handsome. "Hey there, Handsome." I would walk into supermarket and Housewives, it's a Housewives show, it's 2 in the afternoon. "Hey, Handsome." That's just terrible, terrible, terrible. But I did this for a little better than a year. I paid off my house. And then they had me talking to the incoming freshmen. I remember when this building was going up, I was talking to the Kiva, and I would watch this building going up. And it was just bull. I talk for a half hour, just about whatever amused me. And so I got to talking, giving speeches around the state. And then I just couldn't leave, you know. I couldn't take a serious job. Was I going to go somewhere and write about Hawthorne, Melville, and James? Or was I just going to be a glib bullshitter, living kind of by my wits here, doing childish things? Playing jazz clarinet's a childish thing. That's what infants do.
In the library.
in the library. And I'm doing it at 75, you know. I had a good time. I met everybody, you know, I knew everybody. Every college president we've had, from Hanna to McPherson, has been a friend. Some of them very, very good friends. Gordon Guyer is a very good friend. John D. Biagio is a very good friend. John DiBiagio was a friend who used to tell me what a terrible guy George Perlis was. George Perlis was a friend who told me what a terrible guy John DiBiagio was. But since I was always a friend on a comedy level, I once given a talk to incoming National Merit Scholar people, and Gwen, whatever her name was, wrote the test that they took.
Norell?
Gwen Norell wrote the test that they took. And she sat on one side of me, and Cliff Wharton sat on the other side of me. And I got up to speak. These kids are going to take a test tomorrow. They don't want to hear me speak. And everybody's talked too long, but I'm always the last speaker. I'm always the last speaker. I do this once a year at the Tower Guard. Everybody wants to, they've been standing in the cold and they want to pee, and I'm the last speaker. I got up and I said, "President Wharton, would you stand up? Miss Norell, would you stand up?" The three of us are standing, 600 kids in the room. I said, "Now, a lot of you people are wondering what those three kids on the Mod Squad were going to look like when they grew old." Cliff knocked over his glass of water and hit a kid on the head. And years later, he said, tell, somebody said, tell him the story. And I don't know what the hell the story is. I forgot. That's how I remembered it. Yeah. Then I went on to say, because there's a black guy and a white guy and a girl. And I said, well, they'd finally get a job working for Ironside. Ironside had just gone off the air. And they knew what Ironside was. CBS isn't going to have Raymond Burr to push around anymore. But I would do this. I would say to them, frequently I would say, there are 100 million people your age in this world who did not eat this well tonight. And the kids said, oh. And I said, and 40,000 of them are on this campus. I said, we're trying to make you like us. You're not going to eat like this when you get here. I said, 10 of you are going to get full scholarships. You're going to go to Michigan State. Why not? We're bribing you. I said, we want the rest of you to come. And that's what I'm here to talk about. And this is hard to do because these were kids who could get into Yale. I finally stopped doing it because I thought it was not a nice thing to do. A kid who should go to Yale, you know. But it took me a long time to figure that out. But I got by on comedy and I would speak. Hell, I just spoke this summer to a convention on folding and flexible proteins. It was biophysicists. They're talking about genome research, and it was up in Traverse City, and they put us up at the Park Place Hotel, and I talked at the top of the park, and they knew I wasn't going to talk seriously. They knew. But I'll take that kind of thing. I talked to all kinds of conventions of scientists because they want somebody who looks like a professor to get up and talk about serious things in a kind of comical way. And this is what I did. And this has been my niche at Michigan State. And it's over, you know. This is a great place to retire from. You get your medical, dental benefits. You get your parking pass free. You go to the ball. I go to ball games free anyway. Mm-hmm. You go to the lecture concert series. And you don't go to committee meetings. Well, I practiced for retirement for about 10 years. I didn't go to staff meetings. I never went to an English department meeting. I didn't go to library meetings because I don't know what the hell they were talking about. And I didn't care, you know. It was just some kind of crazy luck. And I've been in on it all. I've been in on what? This university was founded in 1855. First set of students didn't come for a couple of years. First graduating class wasn't present at graduation. They were all off at fighting in the war. But 1855 till now is 145 years. And I've been here a third of that time. A third of that time. I'm one of the few guys who came to teach at Michigan State College who's still alive, you know.
Great institutional memory.
Yeah. Well, you know, you remember what you go in to teach whatever you're teaching. I go in to teach Shakespeare, and there's a little bit of Shakespeare and a lot of Crane, you know. And this is what we all do. Although a kid's smart enough, you know, to put himself through college. Kid's smart enough to read all the books himself will read all the books himself. They don't have to get drunk once a week and go to basketball games. They really don't.
I want to thank you on behalf of the project.
Yes, my pleasure.
I appreciate your insight. Thank you.
I appreciate you buying my record.